Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the show's resident stat guy.
I was naive this week, everybody. Here I was, thinking that things would be straightforward, and then the NCAA men had to go and prove me completely wrong.
The men's side is having its own NCAA basketball March Madness bracket where you never know what's going to happen.
I could not have predicted things that happened this week. So things were wild over there. And unfortunately for some of these teams, these matches had massive implications into their conference tournaments that are happening in a few weeks. So there's that. We are also coming up on the end of Love's inaugural season, and the matchups for next weekend's final are set. And PVF has also been seeing some big moves as players return from their contracts overseas, players are being waived, etc. So we have got a lot to cover for you today. So let's get started. All right, everybody, buckle up, because this weekly highlights and happenings is about to rock your world, and it might be very long. So grab yourself a snack while we dive in here, okay? We do have some news from the NCAA women's side. They can't stay away for long. So Grace Lopez, the transfer from Miami to Wisconsin, has torn her ACL. Not sure what that is going to mean for Wisconsin.
Well, that's normally a 6 to 8 month recovery, if I'm not mistaken.
At least, yeah.
She'll be lucky if she's able to get into form for the tournament next year.
Yeah, so Wisconsin's either going to have to pull from their bench or pull from their bench. I don't know. But that is a really unfortunate circumstance, so hopefully she's okay, but it's very interesting to think about what Wisconsin is going to have to do to adjust here. The Italian League semifinals are happening. So in that league, the semifinals are a best of five match series. So Novara is playing Conegliano on the women's side, and Novara actually snapped Conegliano's 40 match win streak. So they are currently tied 1-1 in their series. Match three is happening as we're recording. A lot of the matches in Italy are happening as we're recording today. So if you want to watch, you'll have to wait for the next one. Milano is up 2-0 on Scandici, so that series could end today.
I thought that the Milano-Scandici series was going to be closer and that the Conegliano series was going to be more of a blowout. So that kind of flip-flopped from what I was expecting.
To be honest, I thought both Conegliano and Milano were going to win 3-0. So I'm shocked that Novara pulled off that win, but I think ultimately it will end up being Conegliano and Milano. But it's good to come back to earth every now and then.
Well, you never want to be unbeaten because then you lose at the wrong time. So losing one game in the series, probably not a bad thing for them.
On the men's side, Trentino is playing Piacenza. They're starting their series now. And Perugia is currently up 1-0 on Civitanova. Lots happening over there. The Italian league is my favorite league, so I just wanted to let you guys know what was up. And it's easy to access and watch, so that's another reason I bring it up.
You can find those games on Volleyball TV. So if you don't have a subscription to that, there's lots of good stuff there if you're a volleyball fanatic.
We're just peddling volleyball subscription services left and right on this show.
Well, you know what? Sometimes it's really hard to find where you can watch the games. And so just throwing it out there. So if anybody's interested, go for it.
Are you ready for this? NCAA men's volleyball. We'll start with a straightforward one. BYU handled Stanford in both of their matches in Provo. They won in 3 and 4. I thought this was going to be one of the more competitive matchups of the week. I was very wrong.
I was disappointed in Stanford's performance in this. I was expecting them to put up more of a fight. I thought this could be a statement match for them, but they have not been good in the last few weeks, and it was disappointing, quite frankly.
I think they're second last in the MPSF.
My initial read on them as a team was they were going to make you beat them. That just hasn't been their identity in conference play. They have made errors. They have not looked cohesive. Their best players have not risen to the occasion. They've been disappointing this season, in my opinion.
And the thing for me is every match that I watch of Stanford, it keeps coming up how, well, Stanford was gonna, they banned their program or they canceled their program, and so they never recruited in 2021, blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, well, it's 2025 now. I understand you might not have a group of seniors, but you have some juniors on the team. You have some guys that do have experience, and granted, yeah, you don't have a core senior group, but you're not a team that's just playing freshmen. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I know what you mean. But also a lot of the top teams are also very young.
Yeah.
It's not going to get any easier over the next 3 or 4 years. And we saw Stanford have good matches early in the season. They just didn't continue to develop or play at the same rate, in my opinion. And I think that's one of the disappointing things, is that there was potential there.
Ohio State came up with 2 big wins this week over Ball State and Lewis. So that was big because those teams were all like decently close in the rankings. And Ball State also lost to IPFW though. So great week for Ohio State, not so hot for Ball State. Friday was a wild day. Nothing that I thought was going to happen happened. It was opposite day and my world was absolutely rocked. So starting off, CSUN beat Hawaii in 3. UC San Diego beat UC Irvine in 3, and then GCU beat UCLA in 3. It was not great.
So I think CSUN probably listened to the podcast last week because
that's
we
what
were
I get, you guys.
Not super favorable to them having lost to, we'll call them, lower ranked teams in their conference play, but then coming out and beating Hawaii.
I've been like criticizing their ranking for the last month, and then they're like, you know what, we've had enough.
Okay, so we actually watched this game, and it's not going to be our feature matchup, but
here's the thing though, is we went through so many potential feature matches that we thought were going to be feature matches, and they all ended up being so bad that we're like, we can't talk about this game. This was one of them.
High level, CSUN played almost perfect. Everything went their way. All of the bounces went their way. Every single player on their team had what seemed like a career night. And the crazy thing was, Hawaii didn't play that poorly. They weren't great.
Their left sides were not good enough.
Their left sides weren't good enough. Fair enough. But
and Tread, his setting was pretty inconsistent, especially in transition. But other than that.
I mean, those are fair points. But you didn't watch the game and go, man, Hawaii's awful tonight.
Well, it reminded me a lot of the UC Irvine-Long Beach State game that we watched last week, where UC Irvine put together like a flawless performance. And Long Beach State wasn't necessarily bad. They just weren't. The things that worked for Long Beach State just weren't working as well. And I think that this was the case here.
Yeah, it had a very similar feel. And this is the one thing that is interesting, in my opinion, about men's volleyball specifically, is the athletes are so physical and, I would say, in general, a little more inconsistent than the college women's game. But when you catch a team on a good night where 3 of the 6 players are just on fire, those teams are really hard to beat, regardless of where they are in the rankings, because you have such physical athletes.
Yeah, you don't see that in the women's game nearly as much.
And so, yeah, it was interesting, and you expect the top teams to be able to come out, but we saw, you know, Hawaii just couldn't get it going. You could see Tetriski and Tredd trying to push and will their team, but they just couldn't snap out of it. And whether that's travel or CSUN at home or, you know, pick one of any number of things, they are also young, not a lot of adversity, and they just couldn't get it done.
CSUN is very athletic.
Oof.
They are like an, I would say overall an undersized team. They don't have any huge guys. I would say like the tallest starter is like 6'5" for them probably. They are incredibly athletic.
That
some of those guys
Phillips.
Are jumping out of the gym.
Wild. So there was one thing that I noticed about the Hawaii block, which I think was really tough for them to find. So Jaden Phillips, who is their opposite, jumps out of the gym, but he hangs and waits when he hits. So the timing on the block was a little tough to kind of find against him. And then they had 6'1" left side. His name was Joao, who's Brazilian. And he came up and he jumped pretty well, but his arm was so fast, but he was small. So it was, everything was compact. And so having to wait and delay on Phillips and then come in, and their block was never finished or pressed on Joao. It was, from a blocking standpoint, I think really hard to find their timing.
And Joao was matched up against Tredd. So a 6'11", 6'1" matchup should not have been in Joao's favor, but he did a great job.
Yeah, he did a good job.
And their middle, Shane Nem, I think it is, also jumped out of the gym.
Yeah.
I got the impression watching that CSUN was instructed to absolutely hammer the crap out of their serves. Who cares what happens? And just be fearless on the attack, because they were just going for everything, and everything happened to be going their way. Like, even they'd get hit by the ball on defense and it would be a perfect dig. Like, it was actually crazy to watch. I'm like, I cannot comprehend this. And it's probably so frustrating for Hawaii. While Friday was a bit of a mind meld, Saturday things settled back to what we expected. So Hawaii came back and beat CSUN in 3. UC Irvine came back and beat UC San Diego in 3. And UCLA beat GCU in 5. The question is, though, is the damage already done? So I think we're going to talk about some of that later. And finally, Pepperdine and USC split their matches this week, with both teams winning in 4. So because of all of the ups and downs with so many teams in the, I mean, both big conferences, will this affect rankings? Maybe not so much, but it could affect the final outcome.
Well, there's a couple things at play here, and we'll talk about this a little later, but as we said, there's generally 3 really strong teams in each conference. So winning your conference makes it much easier to get to the final, which is how you qualify for nationals. So there were some opportunities blown in that. And then with 2 at-large bids based on your overall ranking, there were chances for some of these top teams to pull ahead, but almost all of them lost to lower ranked teams. So I'm very curious to see where the overall rankings land next week and which losses were considered quote unquote worse in the voters' eyes. So Love wrapped up their inaugural regular season this past week, and in our head to head, we saw Atlanta beating Omaha 3-0, not shocking. As we headed into the weekend with Love, Madison beat Salt Lake in 4. So that puts them in 3rd overall.
Yes, and it gave them a chance to finish 2nd.
Correct. Except that Houston went on and won 3-0 in their match. So it's going to be Atlanta and then Houston in the 1-2 spots, meaning that they get the bye. Salt Lake held on to 4th place by beating Austin in 5. So with Atlanta and Houston getting the first round byes, we have Madison playing against Omaha. I think Madison's going to win that one. I think both of those teams are just trending in opposite directions.
Yeah.
And the winner of that will take on Houston. And then we have Salt Lake versus Austin. My money's on Salt Lake. And the winner will then play Atlanta. But my kind of prediction is that we're cruising for a Houston-Atlanta final.
All signs would point to yes. We've got a lot of news in the PVF this week, more than results.
Yeah, so let's get started with this, and you can throw in your opinions when you have them. So Eric Sullivan recently attended the Omaha Supernova match against the Vegas Thrill. Who is he looking at? Because he's not there for fun.
Great question.
What's your instinct?
I have been thinking about this so much. I have no idea. I don't know who he would be there watching.
Do you think maybe Brooke?
I feel like she's undersized for what they're trying to accomplish internationally.
That may be true. But
maybe as like a DS or something.
Well, I'm thinking, there's the potential, given the outsides that are coming down the pipeline, that ball control is going to be an issue. They are losing Jordan Larson. I don't think she's going to play into the next cycle.
She'll probably surprise all of us.
Well,
and be like,
that's why I don't think, but you never know what she's going to do. But you need a player to come in and stabilize the pass. And she's capable of that, and she's a pretty smart attacker. So the U.S.'s team's kind of, let's call it a persona, has been pass well, good ball control, run the middle, have a fast offense. We are potentially seeing a transition of style of play with them, given some of their player turnover. And how much can you afford to lose that ball control? And so I think Brooke may be, I don't want to call her a safety blanket, but an option there if you need it. That's what comes to my mind.
She's definitely not going to be a point scorer internationally. So I can see her fulfilling a similar role to Kelsey Robinson in maybe the last couple years, maybe. But when I look at Omaha as a whole, like, yeah, they're a good PVF team, but I don't see any of those players really playing at the international level. And then for Vegas, same thing. Outsides, undersized with Charity Looper. She's not an international caliber athlete. Cameron Hanna hasn't been playing. Also not what they need on the right side. Like, I honestly have no idea who he was there to watch unless Omaha was playing at home in Love the same weekend. And he's like, why don't I make a stop in?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, you have to give him credit for doing his due diligence and watching as much as he can to find players.
I mean, yeah, he has to. But my instinct, and I don't know this for sure because I didn't check the schedule, but I feel like Omaha might have been at home for Love. So there could be that.
All right. There has been a lot of movement throughout the league in the last couple of weeks. So here are some of the highlights that we haven't talked about yet. Tori Dilfer Stringer moved to the practice squad in Columbus and announced a pregnancy. Congratulations.
So that's probably why she got moved to the practice squad, then the injured reserve list. Like, that would make sense to me, at least.
That's a happy entry, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Devin Robinson was waived by San Diego and then picked up by Grand Rapids. So we're starting to see some player movement, some roster construction.
Well, they haven't used her at all. I'm pretty sure she has not stepped on the court once for San Diego.
San Diego signed former SMU setter Celia Cullen. And I will say this is one thing that I really enjoy about the PVF, because I love the management, team construction, how you can move players from practice squad. So seeing all this move and how people look at their teams, I find an interesting part of the PVF. Orlando brought in Melanie Schaffmaster to their active roster and waived Adora Anne, who was picked up by Vegas. We're going to talk, but do you want to talk about this now, or we did Orlando and Omaha as our feature match? Should we leave it until then?
I mean, we can leave it till then. I am very curious about what happened with Adora Anne, because she, for half the season, was killing it for them. Was their second highest point scorer behind Abercrombie. She was doing great and then just disappeared. And so I have a lot of questions about what went on there, but I don't know.
Yeah, it would be interesting to be a fly on the wall there. And I'm not sure this helps Vegas. This is now just another question mark as who to play. And I know that they're looking for something and they are sliding in the wrong direction, but you would just have to solidify a roster, not add more volatility into it, in my opinion. Vegas sent Lane Van Buskirk and Grace Loberg to their practice squad. So, I mean, obviously they had to move some players out when they brought in some new ones. But
yeah, but Van Buskirk's a middle. And she was starting, like, on and off. Like, they were kind of rotating through three middles.
Well, they've been rotating through a whole roster.
Well, Van Buskirk was starting for, like, maybe half the match. Like, And she's not even the same position. It's confusing. Grace Loberg, I understand, replace her with an A, whatever, but yeah.
I'm curious if there are, and I don't know this, rules around how many players you can have on your roster, like if it was a roster spot or why they would move her down. I'm talking about Lane, but it's an interesting, more roster shakeup in Vegas. And we have Grand Rapids sent Erica Pritchard to their practice squad, exchanging her for Eleanor Holthaus.
Erica Pritchard was a starter for Grand Rapids.
Yeah.
I...
Do you think we're seeing a tank mode here, going for a draft pick or a lottery? Or, I mean, that's a legitimate strategy at this point if you're not going to make the playoffs.
I just feel like this is insanity. I understand teams trying to, like, make a push and try to get in the top four, or the top four trying to stay in the top four and this and that. Like, I get it. But, like, these... this list is minute compared to the number of changes that have happened, and it just seems like overkill considering how few matches are left in the season. Like, how much are you paying these people? Like, what about you're introducing new players to a roster that has been playing and practicing together for months at this point? Like, there are bigger implications than just like, how do we pay this person? It's like team dynamics, on-court dynamics, like so much stuff. And it just seems unnecessary to me. Like, it's crazy.
Well, it'll be interesting to see in the future if these moves pay off in a positive or negative way for these teams. Speaking of salary, rumor has it that the PVS salary pool is going up significantly. So currently one player at $175,000. Two at 120 and four at 75 and the rest at 60 to 65. Okay. So with those numbers, we're not entirely sure if this is going to be a tiered structure moving forward or just a general salary cap, but to see the salaries going up is a positive thing for the league and attracting more talent.
Which is also interesting because we came across some numbers this week that highlighted the attendance this season compared to last season. And aside from Omaha, that had seen a 15 to 16% increase in their attendance from season one, every other team, their attendance has gone down significantly. In particular, Orlando and San Diego, whose attendance has dropped close to 50% from last season. So I'm curious how these teams are making it. Obviously, they always talk about how well the PVF is doing, but like, and again, am I positive that this information I stumbled across is accurate? No, I'm not sure about that. But based on the data I saw, the attendance has just plummeted everywhere except in Omaha. So
it'll be
scratching my head here.
It'll be interesting to see if they actually release those numbers and what that looks like. But again, these leagues are generally require a lot of investment up front to get it going. So hopefully they can learn and get people back in the seats. Finally, wrapping up the week, a few more results. We saw Columbus take down Indy 3-1. We saw Omaha beat Orlando 3-1, and we'll talk about that game. And Grand Rapids beat the struggling Vegas 3-0.
There's the clear top four, bottom four. Like, they have definitely separated themselves at this point.
Playoffs and tank teams. And that's how the rest of the season's going to go.
Our first feature match of the week is NCAA Men's Volleyball USC versus Pepperdine. There was a lot of rough volleyball being played on the men's side, but this match in particular was a good one.
Well, we stumbled onto this game almost by accident. We thought the BYU-Stanford game was going to be better, so we watched that. It was not. And then this game was on afterwards, so we just flipped to it, and it was thoroughly entertaining. I had a ton of fun just as a fan watching this match.
It was pretty good volleyball. I expected USC to just roll through Pepperdine. Disclaimer, Dylan Klein, something's up with him. He was not getting set. He wasn't spin serving. Like, I feel like he is injured in some capacity. So do I think that maybe evened the playing field? Quite possibly, yes. But regardless, it was still a good match.
I mean, you have to play the team in front of you. And I thought that was one of the better games that I've seen Pepperdine play. They had a couple players who stood out to me. I thought Ryan Barnett had a really good game.
Yeah.
He had 41 attempts and hit 341 on the night. And just his overall game was really good. He had two aces. He had a couple block assists, eight digs. Like, overall, really solid performance from him.
And this is the first match. We're talking about the Friday night match that USC won. Pepperdine won the next night. So, but the one we watched was Friday.
Yeah. I thought the most impressive player on the floor for me was Parker Tompkinson. If you're not familiar, he's a 7-foot middle.
Freshman.
And he was unstoppable. He hit 579 on 19 swings. And he just looked like he was playing in his own league. He was higher than everybody else. He was moving well. He was a factor on the floor. Every time he was out there, I thought he served really well.
His serve, the angle that thing is coming, it's like a float serve, but it's like coming down at you so fast.
And he had a bunch of digs.
Like,
it was awesome to see. I was thoroughly entertained watching him. Right away thought, this guy's going to get looks for national team. Everything about his game looked pretty polished, quite frankly. And I thought that USC did a really good job getting him the ball. In fact, overall, I was really impressed with how USC ran the middle of the court in general.
Both teams, I thought, really pushed the middle, which was really good to see. Pepperdine did it too.
Yeah, it was a good middle battle. I thought USC had the edge in that regard. But yeah, he was a lot of fun to watch. I was really impressed by him.
He's literally unstoppable.
Yeah.
He had great vision of what was in front of him. He was able to swing both ways. Like you said, the serve, picked up balls on deep. Like, yeah, he was really solid. And I love how Caleb Blanchett runs his offense.
Yeah, he was very good. And the interesting thing is, Pepperdine is also a big team.
Uh-huh.
So while he may be 7 foot, I think Cole Hartke is 6'10".
So,
we're not talking about a 7-footer against 6'5 guys. Like,
yeah.
Pepperdine is a big team, and they're a pretty good blocking team. So he was still able to kind of be in a league of his own, which was pretty impressive.
Well, we've seen Cole Hartke just dominate. I think he's a freshman as well. So he started on the bench for most of the season. We saw him kind of make his breakout performance against Grand Canyon. Like, we were watching that game, I don't know, like a month ago or whatever. And he's had a starting spot since and has been dominant. And he dominated set one against USC, but USC found a way to really hone in their block defense, in particular their blocking, and they caused him a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I like the adjustments by USC on Hartke. Again, this is going to be Pepperdine's recipe for success, in my opinion. You know, Ryan Barnett played really well. We already talked about that. Cole Hartke hit 220 on 41 sets, so he got a ton of balls. And he's going to have to find a little more range to his attack when teams kind of settle into what normally works for him.
He likes to hit over the block to the deep corner.
And that's a great shot.
Pretty much sums it up. And it's been successful because he can go over most blocks.
Yeah.
He hits so high. But USC ended up lining up Tompkinson with him as the match progressed. I don't think they were lined up initially, but USC moved Tompkinson to block him. And then once that happened, like, you're not going over top of him. And that's when he started to struggle. So he's going to have to develop some more range and some more angles, I think, if he wants to progress to the next level. But overall, like, he's very good.
Yeah, and again, as a freshman, you know, as somebody who's that big, that's part of your development, and hopefully they focus on that. But I think he's going to be a really key player for them moving forward.
As we said, Dylan Klein was not getting set.
Only 21 sets.
And it was, like, literally when they had no other choice.
Yeah.
It was obvious. Like, yeah. Something's up.
You knew he wasn't getting the ball.
Yeah. They were forcing balls to Duker, who was steady, but I think he really trailed off as the match progressed, and they ended up taking him out.
Yeah. So, I mean, his numbers are okay, but again, over four sets, you can kind of pad and minus those stats. So he had 36 swings overall, and he hit 278, which...
Well, he was getting all the balls that Klein usually gets.
Yeah.
In addition to his own.
So, you know, like you said, he tailed off towards the end of the match. I think he started well, but... I mean, as Pepperdine, if you identify that one of the players on the team is probably not going to get set, like, that makes your block defense so much easier when you can take away one of those options. So I don't want to say they were kind of playing shorthanded once a team figures out you're not going to set that guy. What did you think of the serving battle? Who did you think put more pressure on which team?
I actually, watching the match, said a couple times, like, this feels, like, very even. I thought both teams served pretty well, but I think Pepperdine put more on it. Am I completely off?
No, you're not. The serving stats were very even. So Pepperdine had four aces and 14 errors, and USC had five aces to 12 errors. So they had a slight edge on that. I thought that USC, I mean, both teams ran the middle pretty well, so the ball control was decent. But I thought USC had a little bit of edge on their serve and pass. They were in system, it seemed, just a little bit more. And maybe that's because the setter for USC, I thought, was a little bit better, was able to force the middle a little bit more. So they kind of look in system that way. But I thought there was an edge there. Where I did notice the biggest difference in this was I thought USC blocked better than Pepperdine did. They had no solo blocks, which is somewhat of a misleading stat. Because it generally means you have two blocks everywhere you go. So they had 23 kind of team total block assists, which is impressive.
So like 11 and a half blocks.
Yeah. Two, Pepperdine had one solo block and 15 block assists. So
11 and a half to 8.5.
The difference to me, though, was that USC's blocks came at critical times in the match, and they had several after 20 in multiple sets. And that to me is just high volleyball IQ in terms of knowing where you're going, being prepared, and kind of dialing in to who's going to get the ball. And they got Cole Hartke a few times in those situations late in sets.
Well, I mean, Ryan Barnett had a really, really good match, but like George Dyer for me is so-so. Like, he's undersized. He's not the guy that I want to be setting out of system when everybody knows where the ball is going. So it makes sense that they are like forcing balls to Hartke, because for me, George Dyer just isn't it.
Well, he hit 095 on 21 attempts. Like, he's your P2. If you're relying on him to score, you're probably going to be in trouble. If you're a whatever top 10 team.
But I think Ryan Barnett, as you were saying earlier, like, he stepped up and he was better than I've seen him play. Like, granted, we don't watch every match that Pepperdine plays, but of the ones we have seen, I feel like that was his best performance offensively.
Yeah, I would agree on that. And you had, again, you had two threats at the pin, both of those guys playing relatively well. That's a recipe for success for Pepperdine, because they don't run a super fast offense, but you have to be able to score from both pins.
Johnny Dykstra, I am usually a huge fan. I feel like he kind of struggled a little bit this match. He was really having trouble finding a defensive rhythm. And even his, like, granted, you're saying they're running the middle a lot, but his passing wasn't as good as I'm used to seeing. So it's good to see that USC was still able to manage when Dykstra wasn't at his best, when Klein was, like, almost unserviceable. And, yeah, like, they managed to find a way.
Well, and I think that speaks to them as a team. They don't have any, quote-unquote, standouts when you watch them as a team.
Well, Klein usually is.
Fair. And the middle obviously played really well, and he stands out because he's 7 feet tall. But they seem very well-rounded, which I appreciate. You know, you have, let's take Hawaii, for example. You know, you have Tread and Tetrisky on the kind of the right side of the court. They stand out. Their left sides are good, but they're not standouts. But you have all of USC, like all of those guys seem like they can score and they've got threats everywhere. And just the way they run their offenses, it's pretty balanced and engaged. And that was, I think, super important for them. And I think they're going to cause trouble at Nationals, assuming they qualify, just because they can run the middle of the court and they have good options all the way around outside. Like there's no undersized player. There's nobody who can't score on their roster. I really like their team construction.
Well, I'm excited for them because they're young.
True.
Like, of the players, like, their middle guy, Guinness is a senior, Jack Duker's a senior, but other than that, like, all of them are coming back, and all of them are underclassmen, except Klein, he's currently a junior. Like, they are going to be good, and they have a solid foundation to get them through the next few seasons, and I think that the way that they've structured their roster is, like, very balanced. And yeah, they're solid.
Well, watching and getting into the men's NCAA this season, I think it sets up to be really exciting for the next couple of years. There are some very good top tier teams that have a lot of young players.
Really young.
We're going to see some great battles for the next few years for sure. Overall, I really liked this game. I thought Pepperdine stepped up and had one of their better games that they've had. And obviously they won the next night playing against USC. I like USC as a team. I really hope that Klein gets healthy and they're ready to go in the next few weeks. But this was a really good game, and I'm really excited to see where USC goes for the rest of the season.
Our second feature match of the week is on the PVF side, Omaha Supernovas versus the Orlando Valkyries. There were not a lot of matches to choose from this week, everybody. And given how we haven't talked about PVF in a few weeks, we definitely wanted to touch on them for sure. Wouldn't have been shocked if this was a barn burner or if this was a blowout. It was the latter.
Well, you got a little bit of everything.
Kind of.
So, I mean, to start, it was a tale of two cities. We had Orlando come out, tied 5-5. In the first set, back and forth, settling into a great match. And all of a sudden, it was 19-9 for Orlando. And Omaha just couldn't get it together. They couldn't pass. They couldn't hit. Nothing was going their way. It was wild. And we had some crazy stats overall in the first set. Omaha hit -026 as a team. In the first set, it was an absolute disaster. And meanwhile, Orlando was all world.
They were
in that
it
set.
Was, I don't know what I watched.
You had Schwann hit 400, Abercrombie hit 333, Brown hit 800, Foster hit 333. Like everything they touched was gold. And at the end of the first set, you were watching it going, they're going to roll them 3-0. Like there's
well, I was just happy because I was like, okay, Brittany Abercrombie has refound her rhythm. Like she struggled for a stretch there and we were wondering like how she was going to do. And she's been like climbing her way back. But like in that set one, I'm like, okay, here she is. She's back. They were running the middle. New setter in the lineup.
Your favorite.
He's being sarcastic. Yeah, they brought Melanie Schaffmaster back or in from her Greek contract. She finished up. Shampoo on the bench. And I will say, Schaffmaster is not my style of setter. She's not my favorite. But in set one, she looked great.
One of the things that I thought Orlando needed to do was run the middle more. They have two players who I think can be effective there. And, you know, I'm guessing the thought process was we bring in a bigger setter, maybe we have a better connection with our middle and we can make that a priority. And for the first set, she did a really good job of that.
Okay, I'm going to argue because I don't know. Granted, I think most teams need to run the middle more. We know this. I say it all the time. I think the only thing that Schaffmaster brings to the floor over Shampoo is her size. Honestly, I think the only thing that she potentially could do better is block.
I'm not going to necessarily argue with you, but you have somebody who's bigger. I mean, Schaffmeister in her last year for her NCAA wise was rough, but that team she played
for. She still got first team big, all Big Ten. Okay. I can't dive into this because I'm going to go crazy, but yeah.
There is potential there for her to be a good player in the PVF. And so I'm okay with them exploring that and seeing what happens. It's a good waiver wire pickup, and it really worked for them in the first set.
She played well in the first set, and then we kind of saw her revert to what we saw consistently during the NCAA season.
Yes.
And my question in set one was, did you guys, Omaha, did you not watch NCAA season? Rule number one, just tip the ball to Schaffmeister and you're going to get a point. Like, hello.
Yeah. So Omaha came out and made a few changes to begin the second set. So they had, they did a double sub at the end of the first set and then kept Pedroza in. Uh-huh. And I thought she set a good game for them moving forward. And they also brought in Batenhorst to play left side for while she stayed in for the remainder of the game and did a pretty good job. So that was the switch that they made. And then they proceeded to kick the snot out of Orlando in the second set. They went up 7-2. They never looked back. And it was 25-17 at the end of that set. So we kind of had blowouts back and forth.
Well, I think the rest of the match was a blowout. Set three, the final score was way closer than it should have been because what did Omaha give up? Like six set points in a row or
six
something?
Six set points. Yeah.
So like, it ended up so much closer than it actually was.
So one of the things that I noticed, and I'm curious if they can fix this, and we were talking about the setting for Orlando.
I thought the setting for both sides was questionable, to be honest. I was not loving Pedraza's offense either. I thought she ran the middle well. She got Kayla Caffey going. She got Horde going. Like, Caffey was almost unstoppable. So the thing I did like about Pedraza was how she was running the middle, but I did not love her location to the pins or to the back row at all. And then Schaffmeister, all of her sets were trailing off the net. Like, and she stopped setting the middle.
Yeah, it was interesting watching Schaffmeister. She, when the ball gets tight to the net, her pin sets flare off. I think she's most effective when the passes are in between the net and the attack line and maybe a little closer to the attack line. High enough that she can get her feet there.
That's how Minnesota was passing all season.
Well, but those were the best trajectory balls for her that were going onto the net for the outside hitter. So she needs to find a way to do one of two things. She either needs to be able to run the middle when the passes are a little closer to the attack line, which she doesn't do super well. She ran the middle well when the sets were, or when the passes were tight, or when the passes are tight on the net, she needs to keep those sets to the outside from flaring off the net. And she wasn't really able to run both positions off both types of passes very well. I also don't think she blocked particularly well. It was, you know, from a defense and block standpoint, you put her in there to block, and she was kind of a liability, in my opinion, from there. Schaffmeister only had one block in the match, and Omaha ran a bunch of balls out to the pin against her. And I thought that that was going to be the part of the game that she was going to be more effective at and the reason they would bring her in over Pornpun.
I did think that Nora Siss came in for Orlando and did a good job.
Agreed. I'm kind of curious why she doesn't play more often.
Me too.
I mean, they're winning, so it's hard to criticize how they run their roster.
Are they winning, though? They were, like, up at the top, and they've taken a dive. Like, they're holding on to fourth place at this point. Like, they had Adora Ane. Then something went down with that. Vander Weide came in, has been playing since, with Schwann. Vander Weide had a really tough time against Omaha, so they brought Nora Siss in. I want to say, was it set two, or did they wait to set three?
I think it was set three.
But she came in and she did really well.
Well, so here's my take on that. Both Schwann and Vander Weide have smaller hitting windows. And when that ball gets off the net and they lose their vision, it's really hard for them to score because they're not in the air as long as some of the other outside hitters.
Yeah, they're not playing that high above the net.
Nora Sis, however, is a little bit bigger, a little bit more physical. She's in the air a little longer. And I think that we're going to see her connect with Melanie better than those other two outsides. And so this might be part of their transition if they're going to play Melanie kind of from now until the end of the playoffs. And I thought she played well. I thought she passed well. She hit 412, like did a really good job. I was impressed. So in my opinion, I think she's going to earn a starting spot in their next game.
For Omaha, they, as we said, started off just on a different planet. And then things started rolling. And they were virtually unstoppable. I think the fact that they ran their middle so much more than we have seen definitely contributed to that.
So they had 24 total sets to the middle between both players, with Caffey hitting 286 and Horde hitting 300.
Okay, so not as good as I thought. I thought Caffey was, like, unstoppable. Shows what I know.
Well, she was 5 for 14 with one error.
Okay, so not good, but she got set more.
Well, and that's all you have to do, right? To run the middle. You had your outside hitters played decent, really. Like, numbers-wise, Baitenhorst hit 190. Payne hit 147.
How the heck did they crush this game then?
Brooke hit 304.
That's still not astronomical.
She got 46 sets, and they...
But, like, what did Abercrombie hit?
Abercrombie hit 234. Well, and the thing you have to remember is that all of these numbers are slightly skewed.
What were the serving numbers like?
Serving-wise, we had 6 errors for Omaha and 5 aces. And for Orlando, we had 14 errors and 4 aces. So they missed a ton of serves. But... again, this is the part where stats can be a little deceiving, right? Orlando's numbers are inflated because they were all world in the first set, and Omaha's numbers are brought down by how bad they were in the first set. So if you were to cut those off and look at them, like, again, you have two kind of different matches from set one and then through from 2 to 4. So, but let's be honest, Brooke Nunneviller runs that team. She finds ways to score. She passes. She plays defense. And she's playing very well right now. Lastly, and I think it's worth mentioning, I thought Lydia Grote came in and did a really good job for Orlando.
She did.
They were struggling. They couldn't find anything. And she came in. She had some big kills. She hit 267 coming off the bench, having not played, got 15 sets. Like, I thought she gave them a spark. I thought she came in and she pushed for that third set. They had fought off 6 set points, and I thought they were going to leave her in and maybe have some momentum going into the fourth set, but that didn't happen. Omaha just kind of rolled them again. But I thought she did a good job coming off the bench, and I'm curious if we're going to see a Nora Sis, Lydia Grote kind of emergence over the next little while.
With Abercrombie, absolutely not. Orlando is like, we don't care how you play, you're staying in forever. So I think Lydia Grote, maybe not, but I would like to see Nora Sis play more because I think she does a good job for them when she comes in.
Do you think either Abercrombie or Grote could pass?
No. That's my instinct. Maybe Lydia Grote can. I don't know. But my instinct is no.
That would be an interesting trio of outside hitters to see what happens there. But, yeah, I mean, Omaha keeps winning. They're more consistent than the other PDF teams. That's kind of what I'm getting. And
they've got, when things go wrong, they do have people who can come in and do a good job. Like, their roster is deep enough that they're not reliant on their starting six.
Yeah, and this was a prime example of that. Pedrosa came in and, you know, she was able to get it done. Allie Baitenhorst came off the bench, did a good job. Like, they have serviceable players, but more importantly, they know when to use them. Because I think there are other rosters that have serviceable players, but they don't necessarily have either the confidence or the cohesiveness to come off and kind of slide into that team. I think overall this was an interesting game just because this might be a playoff matchup. This might be the 1-4 if things hold true. And if you're Orlando, how do you feel about this? Like, do you take away that first set win and go, okay, we have something here, like we can play with them? Or do you go, man, we can't fight with this team for a full match?
Well, I sure hope that's not their attitude.
I mean, maybe not publicly, but looking at it, what is your
takeaway? Well, they had a great start to the season. They beat them both matches early, and then I think given some roster changes, some players taking dips in performance, that's an issue. But I think they need to set their middle more. They need to get more production from their left sides, and then we might see a closer match.
Well, we'll keep our eye on this one because this is potentially the semi going into the end of the season. So we'll see if some of the new players for Orlando can gel. All right, so it's time for our weekly game. And I couldn't pass up the fact that we had so many upsets, specifically in the NCAA men's world this week. So for our game today, we're going to rank the upsets in terms of the most detrimental to the seasons of the teams that lost. Okay. So we have a bunch here, and I've included one PVF because there was a relatively large upset in the PVF this week. But I'm going to list the upsets. I'm going to pick five that, and there were a few more that happened, but five that I think are kind of the most or the biggest. And you tell me, and maybe we'll start with the least disruptive to the season.
Okay.
And we'll go from there, okay?
Hopefully I can keep track of them all.
Yeah, and I can give you a heads up if you can. But so the first one is the Indy Ignite from the PVF, who were ranked third, lost to the Columbus Fury in four, and Columbus is eight.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the first one. The second one is we had Ohio State, who's ranked 18th, beat Ball State, who's ranked 15th. So not a huge upset, but I think given where we were in the standings in the season, that would be considered an upset. CSUN, who is 9, beating Hawaii 3-0.
Mm-hmm.
Grand Canyon at 13, beating UCLA at 2-3-0. We're actually going to do 6.
Oh, great.
UC San Diego, who's ranked 10, beating UC Irvine, who's ranked 4, 3-0. And the last one is Pepperdine, who is 8, beating USC, who is 3, in 4. Now, one other game of note, which we're not going to add into this, but Ohio State also upset Lewis 3-1, and Lewis was 14, Ohio State was 18. So quick recap, we have the Indy Ignite game, we have Ohio State versus Ball State, Hawaii losing to CSUN, Grand Canyon beating UCLA, UC Irvine losing to UC San Diego, and Pepperdine beating USC. Which of those is the least detrimental to the season or least surprising?
I'm going to say the Indy Ignite game.
Okay.
I think the top four in the PVF have separated themselves so much. And Indy was able to maintain their third position anyway. So I think like Indy's not going to lose their playoff spot or get close to losing their playoff spot because of that.
Okay, fair. So we'll set that at 6.
5, I'm probably going to put USC Pepperdine.
Ooh, interesting.
Okay, because you have to think about how the rest of the stuff plays out. So UCLA was 2, USC was 3. They were at the top of the MPSF, obviously. UCLA had a worse loss. So if these teams are battling for first in the MPSF and their opponent's loss is worse than theirs, as far as like a ranking perspective and a like perception perspective for potential votes for the ranking and stuff, USC losing to a higher ranked opponent, they're still going to be top 2 in the MPSF regardless, and probably number 1 because, yeah, I don't think it affects them that much.
Okay.
4, I'm going to say UCLA Grand Canyon. Similar situation. They are battling with USC for the top spot in the MPSF. it might drop them in the AVCA rankings, but it's not going to drop them too far in the MPSF rankings. So basically, you're asking yourself, if you're number one, you're probably going to play like a BYU. And if you're number two, you're probably going to play a Pepperdine. If you're going to win the MPSF tournament, either one of those matches as a semifinal is not, it should not be super threatening to either of those teams if their aspirations are to win an NCAA championship. So while it's unfortunate that they lost to Grand Canyon, I don't think it's as detrimental as some of the others.
Okay.
Three, I'm going to say Ohio State, Ball State.
I thought that one was going to be lower on the list.
Well, here's the thing is like the MIVA is kind of messy right now. Because you saw McKendree lose a couple matches last week, so then Loyola Chicago gets bumped up. Ohio State's been kind of like drifting around like the five spot. Any match that you can win against those like that higher ranked group, so we've got McKendree, Loyola Chicago, Lewis, Ball State, Ohio State, like that group of five is like they're going back and forth every week. And there's no consistency of who is beating who. So the fact that Ohio State can snag that win is, I think, huge because things are, like, pretty close in that conference.
Well, and not only that one, but they snagged two against
exactly, but
Lewis.
It wasn't yeah. in the...
But I'm saying, like, your yeah. logic there makes a ton of sense.
Two, I'm going to say UC Irvine, UC San Diego. So UC Irvine's currently in second last in the Big West. I'm not 100% sure how they structure their tournament. I'm assuming the top two get a bye. If that is the case, and UC Irvine stays... Here's the thing. UC Irvine had to play Long Beach and Hawaii early. So after that, the expectation is that you need to win the rest of your matches to finish third at least, at the minimum. Finished third. Plus, winning that match over Long Beach State was huge because it put them in contention to potentially fight for second, depending on what else happened in the league. But instead, losing a match that they, by all intents and purposes, should have won potentially gives them a Long Beach State semifinal matchup in the Big West tournament, which that should not happen. Like, it should be they should be in the 2-3 matchup. So I think that was a huge miss by them.
Which leaves us with CSUN and Hawaii.
This was such a major screw-up by Hawaii. I can't even talk about this enough. Because Long Beach State lost a match to UC Irvine, if Hawaii had managed to have a clean Big West season and steal one match at home from Long Beach State, they would go into the MPSF tournament ranked number one.
Which is huge.
Which is huge. Plus, they're playing at home, so even bigger. This was in their hands. They just had to take care of the matches that they needed to take care of, and this was one of them against CSUN. So now, even if they beat Long Beach State in a match, it's probably not going to be enough. So this was a massive, massive mess up by them.
So there you have it. Upsets by Sarah. CSUN Hawaii taking the top and the PDF upset being at the bottom. But it was a very interesting week in NCAA men's volleyball, and I'm so curious to see how the last few weeks shape up leading into the conference tournaments.
It's that time, everybody. Listener questions. We've got some tricky ones today, so hopefully we're capable of answering them. But our first question is, will Miles Partain play for UCLA this season?
I think it's a great question. He's coming back from an injury, so we will see how that works. I think he's probably going to get cleared and be able to play.
I didn't think it was injury-related at all.
It's injury-related.
I thought he had to get cleared by the NCAA because he was playing as a professional for a couple of years.
I believe it's twofold on the beach side. I think my understanding was that the NCAA compliance was going to be resolved and he was waiting for clearance from the doctor to be able to play.
So both things.
Correct.
And I believe that if he was cleared by the NCAA, he would have to pay back a lot of his AVP earnings.
I don't know what the stipulations around him coming back
were. I'm pretty sure that is part of it. Like, if you earn money as a professional, he has to pay back some of his money in order to be cleared. So I thought he was waiting for that. I didn't know about the injury part. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, they could use a libero.
Rumor has it, yeah, that they were putting him on the roster to take the libero spot.
Yeah.
Because I would say that has been a weakness for them.
Yeah.
They are at the bottom of the MPSF in digs per set. They're passing. Libero gets targeted a lot.
Yeah.
So even though he was an outstanding setter for UCLA when he played there the first time, the word is that if he does get cleared by the NCAA and the doctor, it will be in the libero role. But time is running out, so I feel like he might as well just wait at this point.
Well, I think he's doing a master's program, if I'm not mistaken, so I'm not sure he's going to be around next year.
Is it a one-year program?
I think so. Again, don't quote me on that, but we'll see.
Dang, part of me is like, okay, if you're going to go back and do your second year of your grad program, just like hold off and save it for next season. Like, you've got a couple weeks left of the season. Just
yeah, and that'll be the decision, right? If he's only here for one more semester, then you might as well hop on and see if you can help your team to a national championship. But if not, then maybe we'll see him next year. All right, so somebody asked, do you know where the Love athletes are playing next year in terms of different clubs?
There is one that we are sure of, and then we did some digging. We found some names of people who are leaving Love, but we don't know where they're going yet. So the one we know for sure, Chiaka Ogbogu, is leaving Austin to go play for Vakıfbank in Turkey. Huge loss for Austin. Huge loss for Love.
Yeah.
But potentially an opportunity for Asia O'Neill to step in, who has been sitting on the bench the whole season. We already know what we think about some of the roster decisions that Love has made. The other players that have been rumored to leave are Drevniok, the opposite for Omaha, Janari, outside hitter for Austin, Rafael Foley, the middle for Houston. Those are the ones that we know of for sure. Oh, Marta Bekis, who she was supposed to be a setter for Atlanta, but she was injured. Don't know if she ever recovered. That's why Rachel Fairbanks initially came in. And then it's being tossed around that perhaps the players that didn't sign two-year contracts are going to leave. Are we sure about that? We don't know, because on some of the broadcasts, they're talking about how they're signing amazing new players. So maybe the players that only signed a one-year deal are out. So those players that were late signings are Jennifer Janiska for Madison, Bia, who stepped into the middle role due to injury for Madison, Rachel Fairbanks, as we said, she stepped in when Marta Bekis was injured, Vicky Savard, who plays for Omaha, and Wokolo. So those are the players that are being tossed around. Chiaka is the only one that we know has officially signed anywhere. We have been looking.
Well, it's still really early for contracts to go out.
You're seeing the top athletes having decided, because the clubs want to know where the majority of their budgets are going. So you've seen some movement from the very high paid players. The Love athletes are not that. Chiaka signed early because she's a hot commodity in the middle market. Mm-hmm. But the other players from Love are not filling that like super high salary role anywhere.
We probably won't see them sign until May, June.
I'm thinking May.
Yeah.
They will probably sign.
And I'm guessing that we're going to get some announcements soon after the finals from Love in terms of who they're targeting. Like, I bet they've already signed a couple players that they wanted to. But it's not surprising to see a lot of athletes from Omaha and Austin going elsewhere. Those were not great seasons.
No. The Love is probably looking at those teams like, okay, how do we make these rosters more competitive?
Yeah.
And interestingly, we're seeing a lot of the Italians go back. Once you're used to a certain level and standard, it's probably hard to switch it up.
Yeah.
And those women have been playing in the A1 Italian League for a long time.
Well, and it's something new, right? You go, you try it, you see what the opportunity is. They would have known a bunch of the American players that played, and away you go.
Part two of that question was, do you think the players that choose to stay with Love will ultimately hurt themselves for upcoming Olympics or VNL tournaments?
Oh, it's a really interesting question. It depends on where else they can get contracts. So if you are in the mix for the U.S. national team and you have a chance to play in A1 Italy, in Turkey, on a Champions League team for Germany or France, like one of those teams that is competing against the best athletes in the world, then yes, you always want to be training and playing against the highest competition possible. So I think you'll see, like Obagu, for example, like that's a good move for her on a personal level.
She needs to keep that level.
Yeah. And so I think that this probably would affect 5 or 6 players who could really benefit from going and moving up the ranks. And just even from an experience standpoint of traveling somewhere other than the U.S. to play and understanding how other countries do things, how other teams operate, like all of those are valuable experiences when you're looking at the international game. So I think it applies to a select few athletes. And, you know, it was Love's first year. We saw what we saw, and we've talked about that at length. It'll be interesting to see what other athletes they're able to attract. But
And Chiaka is still in the prime of her career.
True.
She is one of the few national team athletes that we have seen in the recent quads who decided to play for Love while still in the prime of their career.
Mm-hmm.
So I found the decision by her to even go to Love to be very interesting. You know, the Kelsey Cooks, the Jordan Larsons, some of the setters, even you could argue Haley Washington to an extent, like they are kind of past it. So yeah, I could understand that. But Chiaka, like she's still in her prime. She still has like a quad or at least left in her, if not more. She needs to be playing against that high level. And I think if the young grads want a chance and have aspirations to play national team, like Mrzek, like Skinner, like Franklin, for example, they need to leave too.
Well, I'm curious if it's going to be one of them goes and then they all go, right? So if one of them sees, like if Mrzek decides, and this is, I'm just using this as an example, decides to go overseas and gets a good contract, are the others going to look and go, hey, does that put her ahead of me on the depth chart? So it'll be interesting to see in the next 1 or 2 years what decisions are made.
This is a very challenging question. It's a great question, and I don't know if I have an answer. But if you were king and queen of the NCAA Volleyball Committee, how would you fix the problems that the portal and NIL money have created, especially for the mid-major conferences?
Oh.
The NCAA created a monster, and they can't. It's going to be real tough for them to reel it back in. I think what they did with NIL was a good idea in theory, but the way that it has gotten out of control, it'll be so hard for these young athletes to have existed in that reality and then have it taken away or pulled back. But I agree that it only benefits the really big schools and conferences, which it's like the rich get richer, the poor get poorer.
I actually think the portal is more detrimental than the NIL money. I think
We know how we feel about the portal.
Well, but okay, if we're looking at it from a parity standpoint, like the colleges make a ton of money. They benefit off the athletes, and the athletes are getting their education paid for. I understand that. But the sports grow and the TV contracts and whatever else. I don't have any problem with those athletes making some money while they go to school. It is what it is. The ability to just switch schools and to poach athletes from other schools and just mix up the rosters year over year, I think that's where it's really tough for coaches to develop culture and to hold athletes. And so if you're a mid-major and, you know, you have an athlete who comes in and you know that you're going to have that athlete for maybe 2 years for sure, or they have to sit out a year before they go somewhere else, I think you have the ability to hang on to those athletes a little bit more and to put some effort into developing those. I think, and again, how you police this, I'm not sure. If you're in a bad situation or you need to change, you should have the ability to do that. You shouldn't be stuck in a bad situation. But the ability to just move every year to a different school with no consequences, it makes it really tough.
But I would argue for some of the top schools, like NIL does tie into the portal. Because you can't tell me that Tori Stafford left for... because she was in a bad situation or whatever. No, she left because the NIL allowed her to get paid a lot of money to leave.
Yeah, so those are the situations that I think handling in the portal would go away and leave athletes where they are. So you want to go make $500,000 wherever you want to go, you have to sit out a year.
Right? Well, that's how it used to be. Like if you transferred back in the day, but if you transferred within your conference, you had to sit out a year.
Yeah.
I mean, the top four conferences are kind of doing whatever they want.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Again, I think...
It's hard to police it. Like, do you differentiate between the NIL situation, just like I'm going to pay you to transfer and leave your school to come to mine, versus I'm a local business that really supports the athletic department and wants to give back to the athletes. How can you tell the difference?
No, you can't. And that's why the solution I'm proposing is not perfect anyway. But I'm saying if you could understand the situation, if you were omniscient and looking at the motivation for moving, I think monitoring how athletes change once they get to university could help keep some of those mid-major conferences holding on to their athletes and not just losing them to big paydays.
I feel like there needs to be a limit as well.
Like a salary cap.
Like an athlete cannot make more than X. And I think it needs to be like somewhat modest to be able to bring the mid-majors back into the conversation, because like the mid-majors aren't going to pay millions of dollars to athletes the way that the major conferences do. Because at the end of the day, like, you are supposed to be a student athlete. If you want to be a professional athlete, don't go to college. Like, that's why I think that it needs to be a modest amount to potentially help offset costs for schools who maybe don't have the budget to fully fund a program or XYZ, you know? Because the top schools, they are getting fully funded. They have a full ride. They're getting an education. But if they're given a modest budget for sponsorship on the side, that helps supplement what they're doing. The mid-majors, they could probably afford something like that. And it would help keep students there. I just don't like how they've completely gotten away from the essence of what it means to be a student athlete. It's just not. Our last question of the week is, of the players reaching the end of a stagnant point in their international indoor careers, or the girls fresh out of college, do you see any of them with skill sets that could transition well in the beach? And would any actually make the switch?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here. Well, we've talked about her already. I think the first one that comes to mind is I actually think Brooke Nunneviller would be a pretty good beach player.
She's got a complete skill set, yeah. It's just crazy. So many players that I think would be good beach players aren't. Like, I look at a player and I'm like, yeah, you have the tools. But for whatever reason, I've seen it so often, the transition just doesn't work.
I think you need a very specific coach to help you transition from indoor to the beach so that you can highlight the differences and what you need to change and be very focused on taking what you're good at that is applicable to the beach game and kind of working through some of the technical changes that way. I think if you had to figure it out on your own, it takes much longer and it's much more difficult.
The coach definitely is crucial to helping translate the difference.
Yeah.
But, okay, if we're just looking at skill set, okay, Brooke Nineviller, I think Anna DeBeer has a
that
decent
was gonna
skill
be my
set
second one.
To make the transition.
I think Jordan Larson would have been a good option.
Yeah.
She's not gonna switch now. I think a couple of the setters.
I think Kelsey Cook could have been.
Yeah.
Lauren Carlini jumps to mind for me.
Yeah, she's good defensively. Her all-around game is pretty good.
It is actually really hard to think about this.
I don't know. I mean, you don't see anybody doing this, but I think Fairbanks, like, she's a relatively physical setter. I don't know how she would attack, but I like her overall game as well.
Like, I don't see her running around defensively, though.
Yeah, fair.
Potentially Charity Looper, maybe.
Yeah.
The transition to beach is so nuanced and so strange that this is actually a really hard question. Do I see any of those players that we named making the switch? No.
Yeah.
I don't.
Well, I mean, you're going to make way more money playing indoor, like even playing PVF and not going overseas than you would making money on the beach currently.
I feel like it takes a very specific type of person to even pursue international beach volleyball. Like, I feel like so many of, especially on the American side, they like either have a tie to California already, or they have a history in the sport, or some, like, you don't just see indoor players be like, yeah, let's do this. Like, most of the ones, especially on the American side, that have made that have played both are based in California, so it's like an easy, comfortable situation because they're already in California.
International indoor players who move to the beach generally do so because their national team isn't very good.
Yeah, they're looking for a way to get to the Olympics. Yeah. You saw that with Maggie Kozuk with Germany, Louisa Lippmann with Germany. You saw Helena Havelkova for a second from the Czech Republic.
Netherlands.
Manon Fleer. Yeah. Also, like, the women whose national team hasn't made an Olympics and they don't see themselves having the opportunity, those are the ones that you see go to the beach. Which is how I ended up there.
Yeah, great question.
These were tough questions this week. When I was looking at the ones I picked, I was like, what was I thinking? Because these are so hard. But keep them coming. We love a good debate.
All right. Looking forward to this week, we have a few things you should pay attention to. So, one, back to the Italian League semifinals. So, match 4 between Novara and Conegliano will be Wednesday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern, and that's again on Volleyball TV. And the men's second matches are happening on Sunday on Volleyball TV. So, tune into those if you can. The Love Finals are happening Thursday, Friday, and Sunday in Louisville. The finals are Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern on ESPN2 and ESPN+. The first round matches start early on Thursday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern, and the semifinals are on Friday starting at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. So that will be the season wrapping up. Those games will be worthwhile. I'm sure we'll see some intensity and
hope so.
A lot of good action there, so tune into those. In the NCAA men's action, Loyola Chicago plays Lewis on Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern. That's on ESPN+, and that is that whole mishmash conference,
the MIVA, baby,
of teams fighting for playoff spots. So those will all be entertaining games. UCLA plays BYU on Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern and Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Those are both on Big Ten Plus. And the match we've all been waiting for, Long Beach State plays Hawaii Friday and Saturday. Again, they're super late at night if you're on the East Coast, 1 a.m. on ESPN+, but it'll be there the next day if you want to give it a watch.
I'll watch the replay. I hope it's worth it. All the games that I've thought have been worth it, I've been wrong, and all the ones that I thought would be straightforward have not been, but I've been excited for this one.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, and Hawaii's going to have a fire, hopefully, given what happened this week with them. And finally, in the PVF, Grand Rapids play Orlando at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursday. That's on Roku. And they also play Indy at 7 p.m. on Saturday, and that's on the PVF YouTube channel.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.